Oh, okay. So it would be near the Gatlinburg area of Tennessee.
Fair enough.
This fort was a projection of British power. You know, we want to hold on to our Cherokee allies. We want to show the French that, you know, they can't come into our territory. And so this fort gets caught up in what we call the French and Indian War. And first, of course, the 1754 incident with Peter Mercer is part of that, but also the outbreak of the Cherokee War here in South Carolina connects to Fort Loudoun, most specifically.
You are listening to History Man, the platform for historians, curators, and authors to tell their stories of the American Revolution, walk in the footsteps of heroes, and proclaim freedom reigns. On today's episode, we are very fortunate to have Andy Thomas, the curator of the Casey Historical Museum, and David Brinkman, a local historian and archaeologist, and a commissioner for the Casey Historical Museum. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So today's episode, we're going to be talking about the colonial beginnings in the Midlands of South Carolina.
The sad thing is that's mostly been forgotten or lost.
Sure.
Yeah, but so when we did our archaeology, we looked at 1939 aerials of this area. And where this Granby was, where this fort was, it was all plowed field except for a block around where Fort Congaree, where we would find Fort Congaree too. So it was preserved in 1939. The people recognize this. Now, Fort Congaree 1 had been forgotten at that time because it didn't have quite the significance of this. But people recognized it. You know, and at the fort, we found like marbles from the 1930s of, you know, people were taking their families there and recognizing the history. But in 1960, you know, several things happened during that period. World War II, you know, the Casey House, which was Fort Granby, which this building is modeled after, that was neglected. It collapsed, fell apart. Fort Congaree II apparently was forgotten. There's a professor at the University of South Carolina who wrote an article in the 1930s saying, you know, I've driven off it. This is just right off the state road down here. There are signs of the fort still there, but it's getting overgrown. We need to put up a marker. Yeah. Well, the marker was never put up. And in the 1960s, a development group came in and bulldozed the whole place. You know, they saw, I'm sure what happened, what we saw in the archaeology is it looked like the mound of the fort was still there with the ditch. And the construction guys came in and said, oh, how convenient, we'll just move all this mound back into the ditch here. And
well, give me an idea of how big, and I know you talked about several companies, and then, you know, some companies of rangers, and then some state, a company of state troops. Give me an idea of how big this fort would have been. How, you know, did it stretch out 100 yards, 50
it
yards?
It was... Yeah, so what we found based on the, actually the plat shows it being 160 feet by 160 feet, which was actually a similar size to other forts built in South Carolina about that time.
Okay.
So it wasn't huge. You know, I've worked to do a virtual reality presentation of it, and I was just talking to Andy this morning. You know, some of these things, you know, they appeared to be kind of small, but when you put yourself in virtual reality and you're standing there on the Palisade Wall looking out over the Congaree River, you know, you get dizzy and you say, wow, you know, this is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we tend to forget, you know, we can't visit this place, but, you know, virtual reality can kind of bring back a little bit of it.
So I know there was army manuals out of Britain that described how to build, you know, certain forts. They had, you know, influences, you know, from the European theaters and stuff that caused them to build in certain ways. Give me some clues as to what you would find in this fort if it were built today.
We had Dan Tortora, who is a professor of history, came here about, it's probably been maybe 10 years ago almost, but he wrote a paper on it. He did a lot of research on Fort Congaree, too.
Yeah, tell our listeners how they can go to that website.
Okay, it's at www.historysoft, that's one word, historysoft.com/Granby.
Okay.
That will take you there. You could also do a Google search of Finding Granby, and that will get the first top links will take you there. So for Fort Congaree, too, some genealogy work was done by, it was a Campbell family who, they had a ancestor who, I forget his first name now, it was Campbell, but he actually built Fort Congaree too. He was in charge of building it. So they have some details there. We haven't been able to find the plan for the fort, but Dan Tortora, he's got a description of what, you know, we think it might look like. We had hoped to do some more archaeology. It's right in the middle of a neighborhood though. So, right. That makes it a little bit difficult, but we're trying to preserve it. The fact that all this stuff happens at the fall line, there's a bad side to this. The fall line is also a great place to look for granite. And we have two quarries. If you look on an aerial photo over Casey in Columbia, South Carolina, you see these huge, big holes in the ground.
Right.
That's right where Granby was. And that hole in Casey has engulfed one-third of where Granby was. It has created a slag pile over another one-third of Granby. And we're digging in the last one-third that's there. But, you know, there's future plans to buy up there. They've already started buying up property in this neighborhood to build another big hole there 50 years from now. So we're trying to do things right now, put up historical markers. It won't be our generation that can save it because these plans go out, you know, 150 years for these, you know, granite quarries and stuff. So we're trying to, you know, bring back this history and maybe that will save it, save what's left.
So is there any evidence of defensive trenches or...
So we did find the ditch. So the documentation we have from the genealogy work showed that a ditch was required. They went out, it was inspected, and it was there, it was completed, we know that, and we found it. So we found that palisade wall feature. We started digging out from that. The state archaeologist made us work all summer doing this, but we moved out from it, we found the ditch. We did a geological survey, or what they call a resistivity survey, in the backyard of these people's house. We found the continuation of the ditch there without having to do any digging.
Right.
We're pretty certain we wanted to do a couple other properties to verify the dimensions of the fort and maybe locate what other things inside of it. When you find archaeological features, often you have to stop at that point. We knew there were a lot of items to be found underneath the feature probably and around it, but they don't want to destroy that if at all possible. You know, they want to leave it for the future. You know, there's new technologies coming around where, you know, when you dig, it's destructive. You know, you can find artifacts, but you destroy features in the ground. So, you know, there's kind of a patience to this that, you know, let's not try to do it all right now. Maybe the future will provide some technology that will allow us to do this a lot easier and better.
I mean, it just brings to mind just another slew of questions about what's out there, what's out there, what's out there. But it's at the very beginning of your understanding of what exactly is there. And so when I ask you about Abatey, do you have any evidence of Abatey? Do you have any evidence of wells that were, you know, dug in the fort or even dwellings that were there to house the, you know, the barracks and to house the other people coming in there? You really can't say a lot of that, can you?
No, not yet. We couldn't. We had hoped to continue to be able to do that, yeah, but yeah.
What would you need to finish that up?
Well, there is one family that said we can do some work in their yard. So it would be maybe a little education. You know, we tried to do that in the beginning. We gave a sales pitch to the people, telling them what great history was here. And, you know, the one family, the place we really wanted to dig, you know, the woman was probably in her mid-20s. She and her fiance, she had been born there. She lived her whole life in this house. We gave them the pitch and they just looked at us and said, no, we're not interested.
Private ownership causes problems.
Seriously. Yeah.
Especially when I know that I live on right on Hopkirk Hill. I actually live on that battle site in my small corner of the world, in a neighborhood of other people's little kingdoms of, you know, their little plots of land, and they tried to come through years ago to try to do the archaeology on those particular plots, and it's tough. It's tough if you don't have people willing to give up their property for you to dig in. And I certainly understand the hesitancy in that regard. Yeah. But what a cool find for y'all to have it right in the heart of Casey. Mm-hmm. and Granby. You know, yeah. Fort Granby was not really a fort, though, was it? It was later on.
Yeah, so we'll set this up for Fort Granby because, of course, we talked about the...
I don't want to get too far ahead because we're in like 1754 right now, right? So.
Well, I mean, we talked about the growth of Granby later, the St. John's community, and then Granby, which was a little north of that area. But in 1765, there were two merchants from Camden, Kershaw and Chestnut, who came over here and they built a trading store. And this museum is a replica of that trading store. They eventually went on to name it the Casey House because it served three purposes. 1765, it was a trading post on the old Cherokee Path, and it traded with both Native Americans and settlers in the area. In 1780, it was taken over by the British during the Revolutionary War. They put a palisade around it, and they called it Fort Granby. And then in 1817, James Casey purchased the property, and the Casey family lived there through 1920. And then, of course, David talked about the quarry and how it disappeared, you know, from our landscape. But that was an important structure. And so it started off as a trading post. And remember, I told you, we talked about at the beginning, David and I talked to you about the development of the rivers and the roads and all that kind of stuff. Well, the British recognized that too. It's strategically where it's located. There was also a ferry very next to it. And the British said, aha, we can put goods there at Fort Granby and we can move them around to our armies in the backcountry. And so, you know, basically the British took this trading post over and they stored their goods and ammunition and all that kind of stuff. And they could move it around to armies fighting in the backcountry of South Carolina.
Wow. And that was in the 1780s or 1780s?
So the trading post was built in 1765,
okay.
But when the revolution moved south, and in 1780, when the British spread out into the backcountry, that's when they captured the trading post.
And I want to get back to that, because the History Man is all about the Revolutionary War,
yeah.
But there's this area has such a deep history. Let's go back to the 1754 and the South Carolina troops expanding their influence into North America. And this was actually a starting point of some of that. And we talked a little bit about the poem that Ben Franklin wrote about one of the South Carolina troops helping out George Washington in his death up there at Fort Necessity. How did South Carolina influence the founding of this nation and our spread west and northwest from here?
So South Carolina, just like a lot of the other colonies located up and down the coast, they always wanted to tap into markets further west, Native American markets. They wanted to be able to sell their trade goods and whatnot. And so South Carolina very early developed relationships with Native American tribes. And of course, you know, the Indian trade was such a big part of South Carolina's early beginnings and led to the Yamasee War and some other things like that. But a lot of these colonies, even though they were British colonies, they also had their own interests at heart. And so they were trying to tap these markets. But as Britishmen or Englishmen, they also understood that in the West, especially after the settlement of Mobile, Biloxi, and New Orleans with the French there, that they were going to run into the French at some point in time, you know, in competition for these markets. And so British wanted to hold on to their Native Americans that traded with them, like the Cherokee traded with South Carolina. There were other Native American tribes in Pennsylvania that traded with the British there or in North Carolina or whatever. But they began to extend their influence further and further out into the frontier and into the backcountry. One of the big, I guess you would call it, empire building episodes of South Carolina history is the construction of Fort Loudoun up on the Little Tennessee River.
Now, where is that in modern day?
It's on the Little Tennessee River in Tennessee.
Oh, I got that. What town?
Maryville, Tennessee, I think is the closest town to that.
Okay.
I think that's right. And this they have a reconstruction up there. It's a state park.
Is that Knoxville, Maryville, Knoxville? Is that Cinch River? Is that Holston Valley?
Oh, okay. So it would be near the Gatlinburg area of Tennessee.
Right. Fair enough.
This fort was a projection of British power. We want to hold on to our Cherokee allies. We want to show the French that, you know, they can't come into our territory. And so this fort gets caught up in what we call the French and Indian War. And first, of course, the 1754 incident with Peter Mercer is part of that, but also the outbreak of the Cherokee War here in South Carolina connects to Fort Loudoun most specifically. Unfortunately, you know, just to kind of give you that in a nutshell, the Native American Cherokee had participated with the British in some of the battles that were conducted up north. And when they were returning home through parts of Virginia and North Carolina, the Cherokee were attacked by British settlers. So by the time they got back to South Carolina in the lower towns, some of these Cherokee were very, very angry. And they, instead of going back up to Virginia or, you know, North Carolina where they had initially been attacked, they went on the warpath against settlements here in the backcountry of South Carolina. And of course, that's part of what we call is the Cherokee War here in South Carolina. The site that they put the reconstructed fort is not the same as the other. I don't know if because of flooding or whatever, but I'm sure they have some kind of idea of what the structure would have looked like through the archaeology. I'm just not as familiar with that. So,
but South Carolina troops built that.
South Carolinians would have come up. They would have followed a pathway up here to the Congarees, and then from the Congarees they would have actually followed the Cherokee Trail up to the lower towns, probably into Georgia, the northern part of Georgia, across the mountains. I think I had read somewhere where the cannons broke the back of some of the horses that were carrying them over these Georgia mountains into, you know, this area of Tennessee where they built the fort.
So they actually took cannons up there. That's interesting. Were there cannons here at Fort Congaree 1 and 2? Did they have cannons here?
I believe that, I don't know, I think there may be some documentation that indicated that Fort Congaree 2 may have had a couple. It wasn't much, but
sure.
But
well, then you start thinking if they did have cannons here, and they did take cannons up to Fort Loudoun. Well, cannons aren't any good unless you have ammo, and so you gotta have cannonballs. So you gotta transport all those up there, and you gotta have gunpowder, and then that's gonna be a tough logistics situation to keep those things operating.
You know, and they may have been smaller cannons too, and I don't
kind of like a swivel cannon.
Yeah, I don't know
like
the
that.
You know, yeah that. But there was an object found at Fort Congaree 1 that's interesting. It was like almost like a grenade. It's an early colonial grenade was found, I think, at Fort Congaree 1. Do you remember?
That's
cool. So let's talk a little bit about the. In our break we had, we talked a little bit about the state troops, and you had mentioned that, and they were separate, or in your mind at least, they were different than the other companies of soldiers that were here stationed at the fort here at the Congarees. But they were, you know, the state troops that you talked about were the ones who projected their power into Fort Loudoun. Tell me a little bit more about these state troops.
This was the South Carolina Independent Company that you would find in the frontier forts in South Carolina, including Fort Loudoun, which would have been a frontier fort, you know, up on the Little Tennessee River. You would have found them at Fort Granby, Fort Moore. There would have been some other forts that you would have found them in. And they could be called upon by the governor of South Carolina or by the crown of England to perform certain duties on the frontier.
Right here at Fort Necessity National Battlefield, I see a picture in your office here, and you said that, and this is a, the charming field for an encounter, Fort Necessity, but National Battlefield. And my assumption is that this poster has come from that particular historic site. And you're saying that the people, the soldiers featured here, were South Carolina State troops. Is that correct?
Well, they're wearing green and red coats, which would have been the red and green coats of the South Carolina Independent Company.
And it looks like they're carrying muskets with bayonets on them. Is that correct? And they're marching with the British flag. So they were British troops, or at least sanctioned by the British, right? So, I mean, you said the governor or the king could order them into the field. What was his name?
Peter Mercier
was over them.
Yep.
Well, actually, Mercier was part of them. It was a James McKay who was over all of the troops from South Carolina. Peter Mercier had been called up with a third of his company, along with other companies from South Carolina. It was a James McKay who was over one of these troops.
Very, very good.
Mercier was actually shot twice. He got up both times, continued fighting, and the third shot is what killed him.
Well, it's a fascinating story coming out of this area. I mean, it really, and it's a story in many ways lost. I mean, you even talked about not just intellectually, but lost physically because of the growth of this area and the neighborhoods that have grown around it. When people come to this museum, what would they expect to find?
You're going to get a crash course on the history of this area going back 12,000 years. We're going to talk about Native Americans. We're going to talk about the extensive colonial period that we had here. Of course, these three forts figure prominently in it, Fort Congaree 1, Fort Congaree 2, and Fort Granby. We're also going to talk about the growth of settlements like Saxagotha and Granby. And then we're going to explore what happened in the 19th century with the movement of the state capital across the river, the plantations that were located here, the Civil War. Then we'll look at the building of our lock system on the Congaree that got past those rapids that we talked about, and people could actually ship stuff all the way up to Columbia and back. We look at the development of Casey, which was incorporated in 1914. We look at the railroads, which were an important part of Casey. Doolittle's Raiders gathered here before they trained in Florida and then carried out their mission against Japan in 1942. Mm-hmm. And we've got a little bit more of 20th century history. So we're very diverse. We've got a lot of history. We do have a really nice selection of Native American artifacts upstairs, 5,000 to 6,000 pieces. They were donated to our museum. A lot of them are from South Carolina, but we've got pieces from all over the country. And we have pieces going back to the earliest Clovis points all the way through the historic period.
Yeah.
This museum is a great value. We charge $2 for seniors, $3 for adults, $1 for children under 12. And we actually have free Sundays from 2 to 5 when people can come in for free.
And we do have, you've heard us mention the 12,000-year history park. So that's at a different location here, but there are events, some weekend events that occur there occasionally. Andy often publicizes those. But, years ago, the 12,000-year history park has been in the plans for decades. And the National Park Service made this statement about it, which is very unique. It is that there is no other place in the United States, even England cannot even make this claim, that we have evidence of human habitation for every century for 12,000 years. There's nowhere else in the United States that can make that claim. And of course, 96% of that is Native American.
Sure.
But you've heard about a lot of all this other more modern day stuff that's happened. But a huge part of it is Native American. And right now, that there's some, they're getting some funding to make a visitor center mm-hmm. for this place. Right now, it's walking trails that go around Fort Congaree 1, and you get some tours of that. And they're, you know, we usually have those at least once a month, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're following the KC Historical Museum, or you could follow the 12,000 Year History Park on Facebook and Instagram. They don't have a Twitter account, but we list the schedule of walking tours. We have a Colonial Fort tour, which will take you out to the site of Fort Congaree, where you'll get an overview. You'll see the where the Cherokee Path was, talk about the old state road. Another tour we have out there is because this is also the area where the Battle of Congaree Creek took place. So you're going to get the Civil War, the trench works. You get to actually see the trench works that were dug, and these were dug by African Americans, and the battle that took place there. And then there's also a Native American tour, a lifestyles tour, where you go out and you learn a little bit about the Native Americans in the area and the type of lifestyles they practiced, you know, subsistence and whatnot. So it's free. These tours are offered by the city of KC, and it's a really good Sunday or Saturday morning or afternoon, depending on when the tour is set up to go out. But last year we had a great event, and we probably saw 3,000 to 4,000 people come through. If you're in the area, if you're interested in Colonial or Revolutionary War history, then it'd be a nice little Saturday to come out and check that out.
You've got some things coming up in this area that are fairly interesting that are tied to the museum. Tell me a little bit about those things.
Well, we have an event coming up on April the 1st, which we're really excited about. It's what we call the Colonial Village at Tartan Day South. Tartan Day South is a huge Celtic festival here in Columbia. It goes on for 3 or 4 days. You can check them out by probably Googling it. But on April the 1st, we'll be set up out at the festival grounds, which is at the Columbia Speedway here in Casey, the old Columbia Speedway. And we're going to have what we call a Colonial Village. The Colonial Village is going to have a lot of emphasis on the Midlands as far as the history of the Midlands during the colonial period and Revolutionary War period. David will be there talking about Fort Granby. He has a display. He brings some of his artifacts out. People can come out and take a look at those. We're going to also have some artisans there doing making guns, wooden guns, making weaving, dyeing textiles, brick making, blacksmithing, some of the trades that you would have seen in the colonial period. And some of those, not the blacksmithing, but a lot of those might be hands-on for children and whatnot. Now, there is a charge to get into the event, and you can look that up on the Tartan Day South website.
I appreciate it. Thank you all so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.